the world. I'm John Batchelor with Gordon Chang at Gordon G. Chang, my colleague and co-host and friend. CNN reporting, nearly 40% of U.S. attack submarines in or waiting repair as shipyards face worker shortages, supply chain issues. 40% of the U.S. attack submarines. This according to a new report of the Congressional Research Service. Gordon and I welcome our colleague James Holmes, the professor holds the Wiley Chair of the Maritime Strategy at the Naval War College. He blogs at the Naval Diplomat. He's here to help us understand what it means to be an attack submarine, to have so many in repair or waiting maintenance, and the scale of the challenge of the Indo-Pacific. Jim, a very good day to you. What is an attack submarine in the 21st century? What role does it play for the U.S. Navy? And what does it mean that 40% are out when it comes to the concerns about the Chinese aggression in the Indo-Pacific? Good evening to you.
Hey, hi, Gordon. Hi, John. Always a pleasure. Well, an attack submarine, I mean, just think back to the old World War II movies like Run Silent, Run Deep, or the Enemy Below. Pick your favorite submarine movie. That's what an attack submarine is. It's a boat that goes out and hunts other submarines, attacks surface ships, and otherwise makes mayhem for an enemy navy. We do have some capability for launching land attack strikes as well, but primarily for attacking enemy navies. It's a big deal that 40% figure is about about double the amount of submarines the Navy likes to keep out of service for maintenance. This is actually a symptom of a much bigger problem we have with shipbuilding and ship repair here in the United States. Our shipbuilding and repair infrastructure has gotten so lean that we're having a hard time maintaining the fleet we have, let alone grow the fleet, or let alone repair battle damage. And that's a serious problem for the country and the Navy. As far as what it means for our ability to deter or win in this Western Pacific, I mean, just look at the map and just think about the vast volume of Pacific Ocean that you're talking about. Only having about 30 submarines to cover that, and that leaves aside all of our other global commitments. I mean, that's just a very lean fleet to try to do what we're trying to do vis-a-vis China.
I want to understand what an attack submarine here is in the 21st century. Is this a frontline warfighting unit, or is this supporting or augmenting a carrier strike force? How does the Navy think about an attack submarine?
The carrier task force, we call them carrier strike groups, normally travels with one submarine. Primarily, you think about using them more independently than that. For example, if you look at the map of the first island chain, the offshore island chain that hems in China's aspirations, you can use submarines in concert with aircraft and surface craft to block those straits and basically pin off the People's Liberation Army, Navy, and Air Force within the first island chain. So that would be the sort of uses I would expect to see it put in the future. Also just the ability to make to penetrate forward into enemy held waters, such as within the first island chain, and make trouble for the PLA Navy. I mean, these would be the sorts of independent uses I would foresee.
Gordon, you have a question for the professor.
So, Jim, having almost 40% of our attack boats waiting maintenance speaks to either a lack of sense of urgency at the senior reaches of the Navy, or perhaps management difficulties, maybe both. What is your observations on this?
Yeah, well, I think you're right on both counts. There's obviously still a sort of a hangover from a supply chain standpoint. But I think the bigger problem is that we as a government society and armed forces have not made the collective political decision to restore American sea power, to build up the Navy to where we say that we want it to be. The Navy last year said it wanted 67 attack submarines as opposed to the 49 we have today. There was news just this morning that a classified report from the Navy to Congress is calling that now for a 381 ship Navy. So that's up for by about 80 from where we stand right now. But that demands a lot. It demands more shipbuilding infrastructure. It demands more financial resources. We spend a lot on defense, but we spend only about half relative to our means, as a share of GDP, of what we spent in 1982, which happens to be the year that we launched into our last major naval buildup. We could spend more, and I think we have to resolve to spend more, or else I really worry about our prospects in the strategic competition with China, Russia, Iran, other bad actors around the world.
Is this To your knowledge, Jim, over the history of the Navy, is 40% unusual to be that high for either in maintenance or out of maintenance? And is there something that's happened? Is it the pandemic? It mentions in the headlines shortage of workers and supply chain. That would be a product of the pandemic, correct?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the fact is, I think a lot of people just left the workforce and have not come back. If you watch broadcast TV here in southern New England, where we build submarines, you'll see commercials from places like Electric Boat, which is the primary builder over in Groton, Connecticut. We also have a site in Narragansett Bay. They will offer high school kids who want to become welders or pipe fitters or whatever, or any related discipline to constructing submarines. They will pay their way through. They will pay for their postgraduate education, and if they'll come and work for Electric Boat for a given amount of time. That's how desperate they are for labor. And I think that's true for manufacturing across the country, but shipbuilding is very specialized, and that makes it a tough sell.
Now I want to go to the provocations, because this connects to the fact that the fleet is overtasked and under-resourced at this moment in time. There have been a series of provocations over the South China Sea, over the Taiwan Strait, very recently. Gordon, the RC-135, could you recount that incident, where it happened and when?
Yeah, the RC-135, an Air Force reconnaissance plane, was intercepted by a Chinese jet. It was May 26th of this year. And that date is significant because on May 26, 2022, a Chinese jet intercepted a Royal Australian Air Force P-8 also over the South China Sea. And that was one of the most dangerous incidents ever because the Chinese jet released flares and chaff. Chaff is aluminum foil meant to confuse radar. Some of that chaff was actually ingested into one of the two engines of the P-8. So it was fortunate that the crew was able to land that plane. The Chinese military believes in anniversaries. So this date of May 26, 2023 was no coincidence.
And Jim, I believe in June of this year, there was an event where a Chinese warship deliberately cut in front of an American warship. Is that correct? And is that something that's unusual in provocations?
Well, sadly, it's not all that unusual anymore. We're sort of back to the Cold War in which the U.S. and Soviet navies actually did this sort of thing. Sort of as a matter of routine. Think back to 1988 when the USS Yorktown was deliberately bumped. We call it the Black Sea bumping incident from the Soviet Navy while conducting a freedom of navigation passage. These things are flagrantly against the rules of the road to which we all have assented, and therefore it's a real problem. I sort of doubt there would have been a collision in the Taiwan Strait. Arleigh Burke class destroyers, of which that was our ship was one, has what we call controllable reversible pitch propellers, which means they can almost stop on a dime. So I don't think there was all that big a possibility of a collision. But you never know, and that's why the rules of the road exist. And it seems like the PLA Navy has made the decision not to abide by them.
Two more provocations: a swarm of Chinese warships in the Taiwan Strait, teasing the idea of going over the midline. And then a swarm of Chinese fishing boats in the Philippine Sea. Chinese fishing fleet is paramilitary. These provocations, are these routine, Jim, or is China changing tactics?
No, with regard to the latter that you mentioned, flooding the zone in the Philippine exclusive economic zone has been sort of commonplace all the way back to, certainly back to 2012, arguably even longer than that. That was when the Chinese Coast Guard, or the predecessor to the China Coast Guard and the PLA Navy occupied Mischief Reef deep within the Philippine exclusive economic zone, and certainly a feature to which China has no claim. But nonetheless, they have used the maritime militia, the fishing fleet, backed up by the PLA Navy, to state their claim, essentially to state ownership of the South China Sea. That's what sovereignty means, and that China routinely claims what they call indisputable sovereignty over those waters. As far as the provocations go, I think that if you read in Chinese strategic traditions from people like Mao Zedong or Sun Tzu, they actually advise the Red Army or in this case the PLA to keep your adversary always scurrying around and wearing himself out. They realize that they have the advantage of numbers, and they can keep us and our allies scurrying around. And in a sense, they can weary us, impose these maintenance problems on us simply by doing what they do on a daily basis.
Gordon, to your knowledge, has the Chinese military paid a penalty for these provocations?
No penalty at all, John. And of course, that's the reason, or one of the reasons, why China continues with this extremely dangerous course of conduct.
Is there a remedy, Jim? We have about 30 seconds. Is there a penalty that the U.S. Navy can unleash against the Chinese for these provocations?
I guess the main penalty we could levy against China for what it's doing is continuing to tighten up our alliances, which have come a long way in a short period of time. But short of that, countering what China has done in what we call the gray zone, stopping just short of open conflict, I think we're still trying to puzzle that out. And I hate to say it, but I don't think we've summed up the political will to actually implement any sort of cost imposing penalties on the PLA.
Jim Holmes, Gordon Chang, I'm John Besh.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.